Hi, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to UBS Global Research Pod Hub, a channel that shares insights from economists, strategists, and equity analysts on the pivotal questions and events shaping today's markets. My name is Bhanu Baweja. I am the chief strategist of UBS Investment Bank, and I'm here with Arun Kapteyn to discuss our 2026-2027 economics and markets outlook. It's a big document, 400 charts, 25 essays, 20 investment recommendations, country outlooks across the world. What we're hoping to do in the next 20 to 30 minutes is to summarize between Arun and I the key economic themes and market investment ideas. So let's start with the economics part. Arun, one of the things you note in the outlook is that things are likely to get worse before they get better. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the first 4 or 5 months, we're basically still in the phase of tariff transmission. And so you can really now see that in the sort of the global export data. So exports to the U.S. are now really starting to respond to these tariffs. They're now running in negative territory year on year. And so that bit's the global transmission. That probably has, you know, another couple of months or so to go as importers in the U.S. sort of adjust their demand lower. But then there's also the domestic transmission in the U.S., which is basically, you know, we're slowly, I mean, it's definitely slowly, right? So it's a couple months ago, we thought this would be more rapid, but, we are starting to see sort of more elevated monthly inflation prints. We think that probably has until, you know, sometime late Q1, early Q2 or so to run in the U.S. And so what that will do is erode real income in the U.S. It'll pull down demand. That additional slowdown in demand then pushes payrolls a little bit lower. And that's basically a soft patch that then we think the Fed will have to respond to. But this is all sort of really just sort of the next 1 or 2 quarters. And if you look at what's happening beneath the surface, it really looks like the global economy is sort of poised to accelerate. So you know, we've had the developed market central banks cut their, you know, policy rates in half. They're basically back at neutral now on average. Emerging market central banks are still cutting. We've, I think, got about 9 emerging market central banks still easing policy next year. They're going towards neutral. You're seeing that in what we call the global credit impulse. So if you look at sort of the net new credit globally that's been extended in the last 12 months, that's now running at about 1% of global GDP. A year ago, you know, that was subtracting 4 percentage points of global GDP. So you're really starting to sort of get the benefits of that reversal of the monetary tightening. We've got stimulus penciled in some of the major advanced economies. Real wages are still relatively solid. And so it really looks like, you know, by the time you get to sort of Q2 next year, growth should be broadening out. We should be going back to sort of trend-like numbers. So we've got the soft patch up front, but then I think things start to look a lot better after that.
Right. That's interesting. The other big feature of the outlook, obviously, is tech. Are you beginning to see any evidence of AI in the macro data?
Yeah, you are. And I think it's more visible in the financial markets than it is in the macro data, but it's clearly now everywhere. So the headline in the report is that you essentially have, you know, 9 large technology companies in the U.S. driving, you know, all of U.S. investment growth, about half of the upswing in global trade, 75% of the increase in market capitalization in the U.S. And you're really also seeing it in things like the trade data. So the, you know, we're in the midst of a sort of a global upswing in tech trade, and that very much looks like it has an AI imprint on it. So you look by product. You know, it's things like automatic data processing equipment, you know, not electrical machinery. And so, yeah, you see it everywhere. And what it really looks like is sort of a repeat of what we saw in the mid-1990s, where, now remember, in the 1990s, so this was the early phase of the dot-com bubble, there was a global doubling of technology investment, basically. We're starting to see glimmers of that, I think, coming through now very clearly in the U.S. data. So in the U.S., we now have sort of the same growth contribution from technology CapEx, capital expenditure, that we saw back then. So nearly a percentage point or so growth contribution. But it's really only been the last 2 quarters. And in the 1990s, this lasted for about 4 to 5 years. And so this has further to run. Now, I think it is different, right? It's a very narrow set of companies that's driving this. It's not a global CapEx cycle. I think the nature of the CapEx is different. It's potentially less capital intensive, although obviously the data centers are you know, that is capital intensive, but it's not. Those are only being built in certain places. And so we'll have to sort of see how, you know, how different or how similar it is. But the point I'd emphasize is that this is really the CapEx phase. So, you know, you need to sort of upgrade the capital stock before you get to the actual productivity increases. And I think that'll be intuitive to the listeners, where everyone's still experimenting with artificial intelligence, but, you know, most of us have not really figured out yet how to make it very productive. And so we run models in our outlook where we sort of try to estimate when we could start to see that come through. And it's sort of on a 3 to 5 year horizon where we're starting to pencil it into our numbers, but it's not the next 1-2 years. So the next 1-2 years is really still about sort of the investment.
Right. And that's perhaps a good segue to the US. In the outlook, you say that it's one big bet on AI. What do you mean by that, Aaron?
Yeah. So, you know, the growth in the US is really incredibly narrow. And I think it helps explain why you have, you know, very sort of strong headline, but sort of very weak distribution. And so what I mean by that is, you know, you've seen the labor market effectively sort of stall. There's very little payroll growth, but the headline looks fine, right? The tracking estimates for GDP sort of look fine. And the way you can sort of reconcile that is if you look at the composition of investment and the composition of consumption, it really looks like it's all technology. So within investment, every single major sector is basically in recession or contracting, with the exception of the technology sector. So that is one sector driving everything, and that sector doesn't actually employ that many people. If you look at consumption, you know, last year we saw, I think it was on the order of a 28% of GDP increase in the sort of broader equity market, and 75% of that was basically, you know, tech stocks. Now, who owns that equity? It's all upper income households. So 80% of those financial assets are owned by the top 20%. And so every quarter, they are just accumulating more and more wealth. And we think they're basically driving the majority of consumption now. So you've got the, you know, the market valuation of the tech stocks sort of driving consumption. And then you've got these tech companies themselves driving the investment. And there's really not a whole lot else going on. Now, that's, you know, now. I think if you look at where we're going to be next year, I think we should start to see sort of growth broaden out. We've got stimulus coming from the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act. There's some interest expensing provisions that'll help. We also, I think, with the hopefully sort of calmer environment around trade and the trade deals, we'll have reduced levels of uncertainty. And that, I think, is going to help so capital expenditure broaden out to other sectors. And so really, by the time you get sort of to the, you know, Q2 or the middle of the year, we should see, you know, U.S. growth sort of broaden out and hopefully be back at a trend.
Right. So that's AI and the U.S. economy. Those are the main calls. But what are some of the other highlights globally, Aaron?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the strange things in these outlooks is that we spend an inordinate amount of time talking about the U.S. And you know, the logic is that it's obviously it's the most important economy from a financial market perspective. It's got the largest equity market, the largest bond market, it's the most liquid market. The dollar is the dominant currency. But if you think about the composition of growth, basically the U.S. is only about 10% of the contribution next year, and 82% is actually emerging markets, right? So now, within those emerging markets, obviously China is super important. And I think one of the interesting or intriguing things about what's going on in China is that the last couple of years, you know, all the focus has really been on the property market. And we're now, I think, in the sixth year of the property slump. So we've seen just very large cumulative declines in sales and starts and investment. But that weakness is actually starting to get neutralized by what they call new economy sectors. So now there's various definitions of that, but, you know, broadly speaking, this is basically a lot of sort of the not just AI, but just of a lot of new technology sectors in China, which are now contributing about a quarter of GDP growth. They're actually now contributing more than the property sector. So while the focus has been on, you know, tariff headwinds for exports and the property weakness, and there's also what's called an anti-involution campaign, where basically the government is trying to reduce domestic competition and sort of put a floor on their prices because they're in a very disinflationary environment, there's something very positive happening in China, which is that they seem at the cutting edge of a lot of these new technologies, or at least the firms seem able to use these technologies and generate sort of new products. And that is now becoming I think, a major driving force. And so that's, I think, going to make people think very differently about China and how they look sort of at emerging markets. And then the only other thing I'll mention is Europe. So Europe is, you know, goes a bit under the radar, because when you look at these averages, it doesn't look like a whole lot is happening in Europe. Although there was all this excitement early in the year about all the stimulus that we were going to get, there's a material sort of step up in defense spending. Germany has launched a major sort of stimulus program that will add something like 21% of GDP to their debt in the next 10 years. But then you look at the data and the averages, and there's not a whole lot happening. Now, what's really going on is that Europe is sort of a two-speed economy now, where it is very open and trade exposed. So everything that is exposed to the dollar, tariffs, the euro is actually not doing so well. But everything that is stimulus exposed, service sector oriented, domestic demand exposed, is actually doing really well. And so, obviously, you know, ultimately the average reflects those, that bifurcation. But so I think there's actually something exciting happening in Europe beneath the surface. And so when you look, for instance, it'll be a segue actually to me asking you some questions about it. But if you look at sort of earnings forecasts for Europe, we think they're going to start to materially pick up thanks to some of that stimulus. And I think we're effectively going to have a floor under growth in Europe for the next couple of years that'll make people feel a lot more relaxed about the outlook. So let's talk about markets. You and I spent a lot of time as we were writing this outlook sort of talking about the appropriate terminology to describe what's really happening in the equity market. So there's a lot of, you know, bubble talk, comparisons with the 1990s. I know you wrote a few essays on this, sort of making these comparisons to what's different from the 1990s. But so let me ask it very simply. Are we in a new bubble?
We don't think we are, right? The markets are expensive, and there's no doubt about that. If you look at what kind of valuations the market's at and what kind of earnings expectations the consensus really has for next year, you would find that we are at the upper echelons of the last 40 years, right? Both in terms of earnings expectations and also in terms of the valuation. So it is an expensive market, and valuations are quite high, earnings expectations are quite high, but we wouldn't call it a bubble. And this may sound like a semantic point, but I think it is quite important, because a bubble typically implies that if you think you're in a bubble, then you really want to be selling right now. And you should be worried about not 5% or 10% drawdowns, but the NASDAQ, for instance, in between 2000 and 2003 declined by 80%. So that's the kind of drawdown that you can see post a bubble. We don't expect that. But more importantly, if you just look at the micro of the companies, if you look at the details, the balance sheets, the income statements of the companies, both the top 10, but also broader companies, you compare the 1990s to today, it's really chalk and cheese. And the one key difference is that the margins, the earnings, the free cash flow of these companies is significantly better today than it was in the 1990s. The net debt today, for instance, is negative because the cash position of some of the large companies is so strong. I frankly think that most of the comparisons to the 1990s are quite contrived in any case, because while the micro is much better, as I just noted, if you look at the macro environment, it's just much more shaky in terms of the ability of policy to be able to support the economy over the long haul. Fiscal policy is probably in the worst position in the US in the last 100 years, whereas in the late 1990s, it was the opposite end of the spectrum. It was in the best position in the last 100 years. Consumer confidence, employment expectations, all of them are much weaker today than they were then. So there is this strange dichotomy between the micro and the macro today, where the micro is continuing to do quite well, but the long-term macro doesn't seem to be as positive, in that we do think that it'll make for more mediocre returns somewhere down in the next 3 to 4 years. But at this minute, we think the micro is good enough for us to get decent returns next year in the equity market as well. So we do not believe it's a bubble. The market is expensive, and that will mean that you don't get very aggressive returns, but I think we can still make for decent returns next year.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, one of the issues is, like, you know, we do have a new technology and we don't really know, you know, where it's going, where the winners are going to be, right? So it's sort of inevitable there will be some misallocation of capital. But I think, you know, the verdict is out, like, the verdict is out on whether the business model for the producers of that technology are actually overvalued or not. I just don't think we know yet. I mean, and that's sort of the issue, I think, in thinking about these valuations, like, when will you have evidence to actually disprove the thesis? And feels like we're quite early days on that. I think you had some nice analysis in the outlook, looking at sort of also the microstructure of the market and sort of, looking at the way things are behaving compared to, I guess, the last sort of 25, 30 years. And do you want to just mention, what period we look to be closest to right now?
Yeah, because investors keep asking us this question all the time, right? Where on the 1990s scale, time scale, would you place the market today? I mean, are we already in February of 2000 and about to go pop? Or are we in 1996 with sort of a runway of about 5 to 6 years ahead of us? And the best way to answer this question was something called similarity analysis, which Elena Amoruso helped me with. And basically what we do is we go through various correlation matrices again and again, several layers of that, to try and understand what the market, the way the market currently trades, how similar was it to different periods of time in the past. And this is both in terms of industries, sectors, styles, the yield curve, commodities, FX. So a long whole host of variables, how the market trades today and when was it more similar. And the analysis really suggests that there was a 24-month window somewhere between March of 1997 and February of 1999 that the market trades most similar to today. So if I was to center that, I guess you could say that in March 1998 was most similar to today. So we still have, in if we were just to rely on this analysis, we are not at sort of the peak of the market just as yet. So that's quite important. But I think your broader point about, we don't know as yet, and we really have to ask ourselves some important questions on it. Will the market run out of patience? I think that's absolutely valid. We will have to see whether the producers of AI, the productivity from AI, then diffuses on to the real world, into sort of the consumers of AI, sectors or industries which are very data heavy, which are very labor heavy, would be the ones that are the first ones to benefit. Industries like asset managers, insurance companies, banks, commercial and professional services, law firms, for instance, these would be the first ones to benefit. So what we'd really like to see through the course of next year, because this is not going to be evident in the macro data for productivity, but what we'd really like to see at a micro level is that for companies such as these, we're beginning to see sales increase relative to costs, particularly labor costs, because that's where I think AI is going to help. So we do want to be able to see that this is not just a AI capex trade from the producers, but the consumers of AI are also beginning able to monetize the productivity in terms of higher margins, higher profitability. So that's why we'll be watching the sales per employee of those companies.
Right. Let's switch to fixed income. So one of the problems I think investors had this year is that, the most liquid instrument that normally protects you against volatility, uncertainty, i.e. U.S. Treasuries, didn't really work as a hedge, right? We had a real sort of change in the behavior of the dollar, of U.S. fixed income, and we have a separate piece on that in our outlook. But so sort of a two-part question. So first, what is our outlook for 10-year treasury yields? Like, what do we expect to happen next year? And will fixed income, be able to hedge portfolios, or are we going to see more of the same, i.e. what we saw this year?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think if you think about just the 10-year treasury on a 12-month horizon, you'll find that it's probably not going to change a lot. So our point forecast for end of next year for the 10-year treasury is 4%, which is not very far from where we're trading right now. We're about 4.12% right now. However, as we expect the U.S. economy to weaken over the next 6 months, we expect the labor market to come under some pressure, we do think that over the 3 to 6 month horizon, treasuries can give us pretty decent returns, despite the fact that you might see inflation being slightly sticky because of tariffs in the near term. We think the 10-year treasury can get to 3.5 perhaps over the next 6 months. So we are looking for a rally in the market. For those of you who are listening who really do focus on the fixed income markets, what this will mean is that the curve bull flattens, which means that the 10-year rallies more than the 2-year, which is quite a change in our call, because for the longest time we've been thinking about the curve steepening over the medium to long term, which we still think is going to be the case. But over the tactical horizon, the curve can bull steepen and the 10-year can outperform the 2-year, because the 2-year is anchored by Fed expectations, which we think are relatively well priced in the market already. So we don't see tremendous amounts of downside for two-year yields. We think they can come down 15, 20 basis points, but the 10-year can come down 50 basis points. And so the curve flattens, which is an anti-consensus call because most investors, even over the short-term horizon, are looking for the curve to continue to steepen. Once we get to 350, we think that probably will be the low for the US Treasury, because from that level, we begin to see the economy accelerating. Also, some questions, longer-term questions about U.S. fiscal viability coming into view, and therefore term premium picking up. And so we think the curve is going to then steepen once again, with the two-year staying low, but the 10-year coming back to 4%. So over a one-year period, we think the 10-year makes sort of a round trip from 4 to 3.5 back to 4. Now, in terms of whether or not bonds are going to diversify, the question really boils down to bond equity correlations and how these correlations behave. And the single most important variable driving these correlations historically has been inflation. And we think inflation is going to rise in the near term. Over the medium term, inflation will come down. But then this is going to be polluted by higher term premia as well. Because of US's fiscal, this is going to be polluted by higher term premia. I suspect that through 2026, bonds are unlikely to diversify. Exactly as I said, over a 12-month period, bond yields are going to remain reasonably stable. I think there will be shorter periods of time, 3 to 6 months, over which bonds can do well if equities come under pressure, if equity volatility rises. Over 12-month horizons, we don't think bonds will diversify a lot. And that will mean that investors will look for other assets. And gold, which I'm sure we'll speak about, is going to be one of the assets they turn to. Over the very long-term horizon, I have no doubt that as inflation comes lower, bonds will once again diversify. So I think the story in 2026 is going to be similar to 2025, but I do not believe that that is the story for the long haul, that bonds have completely lost their diversification characteristics in a portfolio. I don't think that's true. I just think it's going to take some more time for that to emerge.
Well, that sort of brings me to the next question. So one of the big debates this year was about the rotation away from dollar assets. And that was really a debate early in the year when it felt like risk premium needed to go up because there was so much policy uncertainty. Where are we on that rotation debate? Do you expect more rotation away from U.S. assets? And then relatedly, you know, what does that imply for the dollar?
You know, when we say more rotation, that implies that there was rotation, whereas in fact the rotation really was just a 3 or 4 week phenomenon in April. What we've seen since then is very strong inflows into the U.S., both in fixed income, but particularly for equity. So there really hasn't been too much of a rotation away from the U.S. What has happened, of course, is that in dollar terms, the rest of the world has outperformed the U.S., emerging markets, but also European stocks. That's true in terms of the price performance, but in terms of asset managers moving away, so in terms of the quantity of funds moving away from the US to the rest of the world, there's very scarce evidence of that. Now, we happen to believe that both in terms of equities, where we are looking for about 10% returns in the US relative to 7 to 8% returns in the rest of the world, and also in terms of fixed income, where at least for the next 6 months, we are expecting US bonds to do well, whereas bunds, we think, because of the monetary policy cycle being completed, are also quite exhausted in terms of their performance. Both equities and fixed income in the US are likely to outperform those in the rest of the world. And so, once again, similar to 2025, we don't believe that there is a major reason for a big rotation away from the US to the rest of the world. And we think that this is going to imply a flat dollar. So we're not looking for a weaker dollar. We had been looking for a weak dollar to begin with in 2025. That was also because we were expecting US rates to come down much more significantly than European rates, which did happen and the dollar did weaken. We think that that could be the template for the next 3 to 4 months. But beyond that, once US rates have come down enough, once the US Treasury yields have come down by enough, 10-year close to 3.5, for instance, there's no reason, we think, for a shift away from US assets to the rest of the world. And at that point, we think that the dollar flattens out. So we're looking for the euro to be in a 114 to 118 range through the course of next year. So we're not looking for a weaker dollar.
So let's switch to emerging markets and particularly sort of equities. So I struck a more optimistic tone about China earlier in my comments. And the equity markets obviously sort of done much better than I think the economy has done. So how should we think about that? And looking ahead at next year, how do you think about China versus the rest of emerging markets?
quite differently about China and the rest of EM. So we have been bullish on Chinese equities for some time, and we continue to remain bullish. And as you noted, there is a big difference between the macro and the micro in China. Although the macro has been weakening, a larger and larger part of the equity market has lesser and lesser to do with the property market, for instance, and more to do with AI and consumer-facing AI in particular. And these are companies that are giving us very strong revenue growth, very strong earnings growth. The margins are strong. ROE, ROIC are still quite strong. And their valuation gaps to the US remain extremely wide. While in absolute terms, their valuations have increased, the gaps against the US remain extremely wide. So we are still long Chinese tech and Chinese equities overall. The rest of emerging markets becomes more interesting because investors want to flock to emerging markets when they feel a high degree of conviction in a weakening dollar, because foreign exchange also adds to it, compounds the returns on equities, and therefore lifts the valuation of EM equities. If investors come to the conclusion, as we have, that the dollar is likely to be flat, then that inflow is unlikely to come through. That's the minor point. The major point is that China's very aggressive investment in manufacturing capacity has meant that quite a few emerging markets, particularly emerging markets, this is not a developed markets point, but quite a few emerging markets have seen a very large pickup in their market share from China. And this is beginning to tell on EM margins. This is beginning to tell in margins in India, in Malaysia, in Philippines, in Korea. In many of these places that China is exporting to, you see sectors such as consumer durables, sectors such as chemicals are seeing lower and lower margins. So you could say that China's disinflationary influence is beginning to tell on equity markets in the rest of EM. There are still markets that will do well. We're quite optimistic on Brazil. There are markets in CEE that will continue to do well as a part of the European cyclical growth story. However, if you look at EM ex-China as a whole, we think that will underperform China and will certainly underperform the US.
All right. And let's then finally talk about gold. So gold is probably the best performing asset of 2025. You know, we've been long gold, I think, in our last three outlooks. I think we struggle to explain a little bit what's been driving gold, right? I mean, it's been way outside our model. So how do you think about gold and what do you expect for next year?
Yeah, so we have updated our models. And since we've included term premium in the models, you do get a little more explanatory power in terms of how, you know, trying to understand where gold is headed. Gold's relationship with its single most important driver, which was real interest rates, really just became completely asymmetric after Russia invaded Ukraine. Through higher interest rates, gold didn't decline. The relationship, just to put some numbers to this, was 1% change in US real interest rates usually led to about a 12 to 14% change in gold in the opposite direction. That relationship completely broke down for US interest rates rising, but is still largely intact for US interest rates declining. And as we expect US Treasury yields to decline by about 50 basis points, the 10-year, all of it due to real interest rates declining, not inflation breakevens, we do think that gold still has some room to go. So this may be the last leg, but we think that rising term premium and the fact that real interest rates are likely to decline, or the possibility of real interest rates declining, should continue to support gold. So we are looking for gold to head between 4,500 and 4,750, at which point we will think again. We still think that the risks to this trade are to the upside. Another way of looking at this is just thinking about, do we have the conditions for a serious decline in gold prices? We've looked at all the episodes through which gold prices declined by more than 15% since the 1970s, and the conditions that we expect over the next 6 months are completely different to the kind of conditions that existed then. You know, the kind of conditions that lead to gold declining in a big way are lower inflation, lower volatility, and we're expecting quite the opposite of that. We're expecting vol to rise in markets, and we're expecting inflation to pick up, uncertainty to remain reasonably high, real interest rates to decline. So through these conditions, we think that gold prices can rise further. And that is going to diversify equity portfolios as well. We don't think, in terms of the flow, that emerging market central banks have reached the levels of gold that they need to in their portfolios. But it's not just central banks. It's also the private sector that's going to continue to buy. So both in terms of fundamentals and also in terms of flows, we think this trade has further to run. Now, we have been long for 3 years. There is a very serious risk of us outstaying our welcome here. But frankly, we think the risks are still well to the upside.
Great. Thanks very much. I think that was a good summary of an excessively long outlook report.
Thank you to the listeners for visiting UBS Research Pod Hub. That was an overview of the 2026-2027 Economics and Markets Outlook from UBS Investment Bank. I'm Bhan Baweja, Chief Strategist. With me was Arun Kapton, Chief Economist. Thanks very much for your time.
This content has been prepared by UBS AG, its subsidiaries and or affiliates, and is purely informational in nature. It is not investment research and does not contain an investment recommendation, nor investment or professional advice. It is not an offer or solicitation to engage in any investment activity, and you should seek your own financial, tax, and legal advice before engaging in any such activity. UBS has no responsibility to you in relation to this content and has no regard to your personal circumstances or investment objectives, and receiving it does not imply any form of client relationship with UBS for any legal, regulatory, or tax purpose. This content is not intended for distribution into any jurisdiction, where to do so would be contrary to law or regulation. UBS does not accept any liability over the content of such material or reliance upon any information contained herein. The views and opinions expressed by any guest speaker or third party are not those of UBS. Accordingly, UBS does not accept liability over any such views and opinions expressed by such persons. This content is the valuable intellectual property of UBS, and UBS specifically prohibits the redistribution of it in whole or in part without its prior written permission. UBS 2025. The key symbol and UBS are among the registered and unregistered trademarks of UBS. All rights reserved.